Okay, here we go with another edition of My Car Guru. Hey, I'm Lenny Lawson, the car guru, and I arrived in style today. I drove my 1962 Corvair Rampside pickup truck. Now, if you've never seen one of those, then you're forgiven because they didn't build them very long. They weren't very successful. But it's a cool truck. It actually has a van front end. Okay, just imagine a flat-nosed van front end, and then it stops right behind the driver, kind of like a pickup truck does. And then there's a bed. And the weird thing about this particular vehicle is it has the engine in the rear, like a Corvair. Those of you that are too young to remember, Chevrolet came out with a innovative product to kind of go after Volkswagen, and it was called the Corvair, introduced in 1960 and sold all the way through 1969, but it was... and it sold really well initially. These trucks and vans did not. The truck had a ramp on the side that folds down. So imagine a pickup truck without not an extended cab or a crew cab or anything, just a regular old normal cab pickup truck. Okay, so you open up the passenger side door, you take a right-hand turn, and right there on the side of the bed is a fold-down ramp that actually fold down and touch the ground. I'm telling you, it makes a great garbage can hauler, and that's what I use it for at my house. We also haul stuff to the dump, and every time we go, I shouldn't call it the dump, it's the recycling center. That sounds better, doesn't it? So we go to the recycling center. We are a hit. I mean, people come from all directions saying, "What is that?" And we tell them about, kind of take them back to the early days of the 60s. But it is a very functional vehicle for us, but not, it didn't sell very well. So what do they do when things don't sell well? They cancel them. But the Corvair lingered on. They changed the body styles in 1965. I have a Corvair convertible 1965 model that I love dearly. And it drives really good, but, there were some problems. The Corvair had swing axles, which if you don't keep the air pressures right in your tires, then the swing axle can be a problem, especially for people who are used to driving a rear-wheel drive car with an engine in the front, with a more normal weight distribution. With a rear-engine, rear-drive car, most of your weight's in the back. And it's just kind of weird when it comes to handling and you have to adjust the air pressures. Well, there was a problem with the swing axle and the rear drive and without the proper air pressures, and people were losing control of their Corvairs. And a guy named Ralph Nader called attention to it, among other General Motors issues. And the name of the book that he wrote was Unsafe at Any Speed. And that was somewhat a problem for General Motors. So they redesigned the car and came out with a 1965 model and it didn't have the same type of rear suspension and solved the problem. But by then the Mustang had come out and the Mustang was extremely successful and Chevrolet held on for a while and finally pulled the plug on the Corvair in 1969. I think the Corvair would have survived had it not been for the early snafu with the rear suspension. I think it could have even survived the Mustang. But, you only get one chance at a introduction, and sometimes it fails. Sometimes, there are many nameplates out there that have stood the test of time. They have evolved. You think about names like Silverado, Corvette, another Chevrolet, F-150, Mustang, Camaro, Honda Accord, Camry, Civic, these are all cars that have, they're nothing like the cars that they were when they first came out, but they have completely reinvented themselves, but maintain the same name. It's a successful brand. There are other examples that are equally unsuccessful. Remember the Dodge Swinger? How about the Ford Probe? Now, who in the world came up with that name? A Probe... Come on, that's something that doctors use, right? Buick LaCrosse, AMC Matador, or the Gremlin, or the Pacer for that matter. Pacer, I don't think that's a bad name. Gremlin, not a good start, I don't think. Chevy Vega, of course, I think that's the name of a star, isn't it? Vega, or a system, out there somewhere in space? The Chrysler Cordoba. Remember the spokesman for that? That's right, Ricardo Montalban, and that rich Corinthian leather. Even that could not save the Cordoba. I think that was a Pontiac Grand Prix and Chevy Monte Carlo competitor, but not a very good one, by the way. So, you know, some cars, some brands can fail because of just bad marketing, bad timing. Look how many times that Chevrolet has tried to resurrect names, like the Nova. You know, originally it was the Chevy 2, and then they came up with Nova, but they couldn't call it Nova in any Spanish-speaking country because Nova or Noba is translated as no go. So that didn't work. There are some others. The original midsize Chevrolet was called, well, in the 60s, was called the Chevelle. I thought that was a good name. Then they decided to call it the Malibu. And then they killed the Malibu. And then they brought it back. And then they killed it again and brought it back the last time. And I guess they still sell a Malibu. I don't know. But there are a lot of things that can kill a brand, in addition to bad engineering, bad marketing. You know, just not building something that people really want or can identify with, like the Pontiac Aztec. You know, here was a vehicle that was originally a minivan. It was designed to be a competitor for the Chrysler minivans, which included the Dodge Caravan, the Plymouth Voyager, and the Chrysler Town and Country. So what does Chevrolet do? Well, they come out with this vehicle line called the Lumina. Well, it was a four-door sedan. And it was the successor of the Chevy Celebrity. And so they called it the Lumina. Well, then they said, well, let's come out with a minivan because our Astro van really is a rear-wheel drive van. It doesn't compete very well with the Chrysler front-wheel drive minivan. So let's come out with this thing. Let's call it a Lumina APV and then make it look like a dust buster. Well, that didn't work very good, so they decided to redesign it again and say, let's call it the Chevy Venture Van. And let's see, what was the Oldsmobile version? The Silhouette. Most people couldn't even pronounce that. It looked like Sil Howitt. And then the Buick. What was Buick's called? I don't even remember. You know, GM was into so much of this rebadging, and that's what pretty much led to their demise eventually when the Great Recession, the last Great Recession, happened, and GM had to declare bankruptcy. It was so many brilliant decisions. But the most brilliant of all was when they came out with the Pontiac Aztec. Yeah, the Aztec was General Motors' answer to the SUV generation. When you can't afford to build a fresh new SUV, you just build something off of a minivan chassis and call it an SUV because you add on a bunch of weird-looking accoutrements. I don't even know if that's the word, but add-ons, including a tailgate that was see-through, basically. I still see Aztecs driving around every now and then. It just reminds me how horrible General Motors can be sometimes. But, you know, I'm not just picking on GM. Ford made some wonderful decisions. One of them was called the Granada. Another, the Aerostar. Remember the Aerostar vans? Of course, some of you may have loved these vehicles, so in that case, you have my apology. But you know, when I look out on the automotive landscape right now, I don't see a lot of those engineering nightmares. Yeah, we do have a lot of recalls. I think building a new vehicle these days is so complex, and there are going to be issues that happen. As long as the manufacturers step up to the plate and they don't have one right after the other, then we're okay. But I think we are in a golden age of design in terms of cars. Definitely we are in terms of performance, just in time for us to go full electric. So it is a weird, wacky world out there in the automobile business, and I'll try to keep you up to speed and up to date on what's going on. So we'll take our first break and be back here in just a second. Okay, I'm back. I do want to touch on something that's costing a lot of you some serious money. And it's one of those things where people get so excited about buying a new car, they forget to think about financing it and all the stuff that happens after they've already made the decision to buy the car. And that's what happens in the finance office right after. Now, you're going to be presented with opportunity to buy certain things in the finance office some of which you should run from, others you might want to consider, you know, depending on your circumstances. Now, there's a lot of publicity right now going on in the industry about gap insurance. You ever heard of gap insurance? Well, GAP stands for Guaranteed Asset Protection. And it's been receiving a lot of attention in state capitals lately. Lawmakers are kind of fired up about selling GAP, and especially who buys GAP. So what is GAP? Well, let's say that you buy a car, and 6 months later, of course, you've got insurance on it, and you've got it financed, and you owe $25,000 on the car, but your insurance company only wants to pay you $20,000 because that's the book value of the car. The insurance company, like State Farm or Farm Bureau, is not liable for what you owe on the car. They're only liable for what the current market value is of the car. Now, sometimes that's negotiable. But what you owe on it is not. I mean, the bank, you know, if your car is totaled, for example, or if it's stolen, the insurance company may pay $20,000, but you owe the bank $25,000, and the bank is not just going to settle with you. They want their $25,000. And so gap insurance steps in and pays that extra $5,000 for you. Sounds like a good thing, right? But what if you buy a car and you pay 20% down? And let's say that you're only financing, let's say, 70, 80% of what the value of the car is when you buy the car. You don't have any business buying gap insurance. Now, the finance manager, if he's a very profit-minded kind of guy, gal, which a lot of them are, they may still present you with gap insurance. And they may say something like, well, you know, this car could depreciate faster than what you think, and so forth. Don't buy that stuff. Just, you know, if you're financing what the car is worth, if you're paying nothing down, or if you're upside down on the car you're trading in, meaning that you owe more on the car that you're trading in than what they're giving you for it or paying you for it, then you might want to consider gap insurance. But remember, gap only pays if you wreck your car and total it, or if your car is stolen. In other words, you don't have the car anymore. The collateral for the loan is gone. So then you would have to step up and pay the deficiency to the bank. So gap insurance steps in and does that for you. So that is a product for some people, but not for everyone. Now, some other things that will be offered to you in a dealership when you buy a car are things like service contracts, which is most often called an extended warranty. But as I tell you, warranties are only offered by the manufacturer of a product. So it's not a warranty. It is a service contract. And it's an agreement. It does basically the same thing. It, you know, if you have a part, a covered part that fails, then the insurance company backing the service contract is going to pay for that claim subject to your deductible. Does that make sense? Okay, another thing that you can buy is prepaid maintenance in a finance office. But you got to do the math here. I mean, so they're going to, the big sales pitch right now is, well, you know, the cost of oil is just going to go up, up, and up. Yeah, it probably is. But an oil change is still going to be less than $100. I know that maybe sounds like a lot for an oil change, but I mean, have you been to a Jiffy Lube lately? Prepaid maintenance just basically does what it says. You can finance your oil changes and tire rotations for the next however many years you choose to cover it. Do you really need to finance your oil changes and pay interest on it? Maybe you do. I don't know. If you do, then do it that way. Put it in a monthly payment. Then you don't have to worry about it. But if you don't, just pay for your oil changes. They're also going to offer you various other protection packages. This is where you need to watch out. These protection packages, backed by insurance, cover certain things that can happen to a car. Nothing that is really covered by your car insurance, okay, like through State Farm or Farm Bureau or somebody like that, or Liberty. These cover cosmetic things like paint, fabric, the wheels. Now, the wheels could be covered by your collision insurance. If you hit a, you know, a wheel that costs $2,000 and you got a $100 deductible, then that's covered. However, a lot of dealers will sell you wheel protection coverage. which means that if you damage your wheels beyond a repairable level, then they'll replace the wheel. Now, wheels are expensive. We sold a Shelby GT500 the other day that had carbon fiber wheels. The replacement cost on those wheels are about $6,000 each. So, yeah, you'd want to buy insurance on that. They also sell something called dent and ding protection. You know what I'm talking about. Not like a collision. It's the one where you go to Ingles like I did the other day, and somebody opened the door on my wife's Nissan Frontier truck. Put a nice little mark on it. Didn't break the paint, thank goodness. So the dent doctor, who comes to the dealership every week, can push that out for about $30. Well, you can buy insurance coverage for that in a finance office. Another thing is key replacement. Have you priced a key lately? You know, it's not like the old days when I used to cut keys in the parts department at the Chevy store. I was really good at that. You look up a key code and you get this little trigger-like thing and you put it in there. No mechanical, nothing that, you know, is automated. We just did it always by hand. And the key was, I think $1.50 for the key and maybe another dollar to get it cut. You know, a key can cost $400, $500, $600 now. I know, it's crazy. But that's something that you can buy in a finance office. Now, should you? Depends, again, on your financial situation and what's covered. Who's backing that paint and fabric warranty, by the way? And what does it cover when it comes to paint? Does it cover fallout from the environment? Do you have to do anything to maintain that warranty? Do you have to have the car inspected? Do you have to prove how many car washes? Do you have to agree to, you know, never go through a car wash? You know, that's going to hit it with those brushes spinning at hundreds of miles an hour with little rocks in them. That's another thing, folks. Don't drive your car through an automatic car wash. Wash it by hand. If you have a black car or any car with any kind of black trim on it, you're going to scratch it to pieces if you keep doing that. So anyway, that's a side note. Another thing that you have to really watch out for in some finance offices, what is packed into that payment that they've already quoted you? I'll tell you what's supposed to be packed in that payment that they've already quoted you out there on the sales floor. Nothing. Nothing is supposed to be packed in that payment or included in that monthly payment out on the sales floor. You should be able to go into the finance office knowing that there's nothing included in that payment and that anything else that you're going to pay for, you're going to know what it's going to cost, total cost, and then you're going to know what it's going to cost if they add it into your monthly payment. This is how a lot of car dealers make a lot of extra money, is by packing stuff in there before you go to the finance office. And then they say, oh, by the way, included in your monthly payment at no extra charge is this, 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 and this. And your next question said, I didn't ask for any of that stuff. And the guy says, well, but it's included. I said, well, how much is included? How much is that stuff costing? And what does it cost if I don't take any of it? And then they may say, well, you have to take it because it's already on the car. I said, I don't have to take it. They didn't say anything to me about that out there, and I'm not taking it. Otherwise, I'm leaving. I don't want you to sound too mean or arrogant or anything, and I don't mean to sound that, but that's just kind of the way it is. You got to play hardball if they're playing hardball with you. So anyway, there's some advice for you when you go into the finance office and some of the stuff that you might see. One of the things that gets packed a lot in the payment is something called etch. And what that is they take these little stickers, which will actually etch. It's got a little acid in it, I guess, and it etches the glass and puts the last 7-8 digits of your VIN number in the glass. What does that do for you? Well, if your car is stolen, they can find it. If they can find the glass that has the etch mark on it, they can trace it back to you. Big whoop. I mean, that's of no value to anybody, so don't be buying that etch stuff. All right, so I'll be back here in just a second. Okay, I'm back. You know, there are a lot of car dealers that listen to this show. Car salespeople, dealers, sales managers, they do not like it when I talk about stuff that I did in the last segment because it takes money out of their pocket. But you know, the way I look at it is if they handle it the right way, it does not take any money out of their pocket. If they price the finance products, you know, warranties, maintenance, service contracts, protection packages, if they price them fairly with a reasonable markup, and there is some real value there for a consumer, then what do they have to be afraid of? People will buy it if they perceive the value. But, you know, it's their responsibility to present the value, not to just assume that the customer wants that and then charge them for it. That is illegal and unethical. It's called payment packing. If you feel like that's been done to you, then complain to your attorney general, complain to the Federal Trade Commission. You know, that's the only way that you get this kind of stuff stopped. Sonic Automotive got nailed for this probably 20 years ago in the North Carolina market over in Charlotte someplace. And you know, it's public record, so I can say that. I don't think they do it anymore, but who am I to know? I mean, all I can say is they were doing it then. And it is something that is very anti-consumer and gives just another one of those things that gives car dealers a bad name. Now, the vast majority of car dealers do not do this stuff. Most of them are straightforward business people just trying to make a living, and all their salespeople and finance managers and service people are the same. But, you know, in any industry, I don't care if it's real estate or insurance or lawyers or you know, people who spray your house for bugs, they're a ripoff artist in every field. And you know this because you've had to deal with them. It's not just car dealers. And so just, you know, all you have to do is be prepared and listen to this radio show and tell your kids and your in-laws to listen, you know, and they'll learn something that'll save them some money down the road. And I'm not talking about little money. You know, I consider paying $1,000 for nothing a waste of money, don't you? And that's something that you need to be aware of and you can pass on to your kinfolk. Well, thanks for listening to this edition of My Car Guru, and I promise I'll be back with a live show tomorrow. Thank you.